I must say, as I look around this distinguished audience, it occurs to me that when I was running for president, it was the Democrats who complained about a one-party press. How things have changed, and for the better, I mean. They've even changed. I'm told by Mr. Chambers in Dallas, where I suffered certain indignities a year and a half ago, and Jim Chambers tells me that that night when I was assaulted, he sent me a telegram, which I now recall very well, and I must tell him that I also received another telegram that evening when the police asked me whether I should like to have the assailants sent to jail. I said, no, I'd prefer to have them sent to school. And this apparently appeared on the television. Thereupon, I had a telegram from Boston, which said, Governor, I've always loved you, but what I love about you most is your magnitude. That after 6 weeks on Metrocal. Now, there were many times in the past when I should like to have had the opportunity to speak to this captive audience, but I'm flattered that you invited me to address you, address this most influential of all American audiences, even belatedly. I once asked Alvin Barkley, who is the daddy of all public speakers, I dare say, in our time, what he considered the best kind of audience. And he said without hesitation, the best audience is intelligent, educated, and a little drunk. Moreover, I must say I was delighted to come here because things are... things are usually so tense where I work that the United Nations, and I might say in the State Department, that I welcome... that I welcome occasional opportunities to speak elsewhere. Especially where there is no right of reply. Well, I don't know. Like the gambler who was going to the racetrack, I hope I come out even. I need the money. The trouble is that Monsignor Deneen has made an invocation that leaves me with very little to say. Concluded this ponderous address, you might remember that I could have said, let us pray. Now, as you would expect, I must preach a little from a familiar text. At the International Affairs, at the United Nations, we always seem to be on a collision course with the communists over something or other. And there are those, even in the press, who seem to relish collisions more than they do cooperation. It reminds me of the hillbilly who came to town looking for a job as a switchman on the railway. And the boss decided to give him a test. And he said, if two trains are approaching from the opposite direction on the same track at 60 miles an hour, what would you do, young man? And the boy promptly replied that he would run as fast as he could to get his brother. Because, he said, my brother ain't never seen a big train wreck. I sometimes think about that story only remotely in relation to the press. But I suggest to you that it is cooperation and not collision that will preserve the peace of the world, and I commend to you something that the distinguished, able, and overburdened Secretary General of the United Nations, U Thant, said at the ANPA luncheon here only yesterday. He said it is a truism that news is what sells newspapers. And I don't question the need for an element of drama and excitement in the popular press. But this is an attitude which, if carried too far, can produce a gloomy or sensational picture of events which cannot fail to have repercussions on the opinions and reactions of peoples and of governments. An undue concentration on violence and conflict inevitably creates a heated atmosphere which is unfavorable to reason and conciliation. In that connection, I should like to say to you publishers that to cover 114 nations and a huge secretariat, all dealing with a vast variety of problems, is not an easy task. And on the whole, I have found that the correspondents who cover the United Nations are informed, are temperate, and also responsible. And I suggest that it is well that they are, because one could suspect that many delegates from abroad form their judgments of our country and its positions more from what they read in our newspapers than from what the likes of me tell them. It's well that your foreign affairs reporters are competent, because the reporting and the interpretation of foreign affairs is becoming perhaps not only the most intricate and difficult, but the greatest single responsibility of the press. That is, if you consider the preservation of peace as our paramount problem. And heaven help this republic if your coverage is false, if it's distorted, if it's inflammatory, or perhaps worst of all, out of key with the moving forces of history which mold our society and our neighbors' societies and the whole vast developing drama of the human race. Once upon a time, as Mr. Strong said, before most of you were born, I too was a newspaper man. And I have rather fancied myself as just a frustrated journalist ever since. I think I can illustrate the frustration by informing you, as I did an old colleague, an old friend here from Princeton a moment ago, that in my senior year I was editor of the Daily Princetonian. And there I made $1,500 in my senior year. And there were two fellows who came to the Princeton campus who tried to get me to invest that money in a little magazine. One was named Harry Luce and the other was Britton Haddon. Lest you have any doubt about my competence as a diplomat, I want to assure you that I was too smart for it. But if I'm reconciled to your difficulties, I hope only by contemplation of my own. And if you have any trouble with reconciliation of your own, I remind you of what Nikita Khrushchev said at a Moscow reception, which I attended one time. When Western correspondents had complained that it was very hard to get news about the Soviet-Chinese ideological negotiations then going on in Moscow, and Khrushchev retorted, "Any fool could be a journalist." I rather felt that way. And then he added, "If the job were not so difficult." Well, I think your editors and reporters will once more be on their mettle next week when the members of the United Nations Disarmament Commission, all 114 countries, gather to take up again the formidable task of stopping the arms race and pushing ahead toward that distant yet urgent goal called general and complete disarmament. There will be plenty of noise to report, plenty of propaganda and polemics, and those interested only in reporting noise will be content with the show. But for those who want to report what the noise portends, The assignment will be no job for fools. In the disarmament commission, we will proceed against a background of a global arms race and a number of regional arms races. They are directly the product of fear and suspicion and the absence of political settlements of international conflicts. Since the Second War, we ourselves have spent, I remind you, $800 billion on our military establishment, an amount that exceeds the production of all of the nations of Asia, Africa, and Latin America last year. Literally hundreds of billions of dollars were spent by the Europeans and ourselves, mainly to convince aggressors that aggression does not pay, that it has no future, whether in Central Europe or in Korea or anywhere else, including Vietnam. In each major region of the world, aggressions and threats and uncertainties are driving up the cost of nationhood and driving down the standard of living. Communist China is depriving the people of that great and ancient land of the chance for rapid development because it wants to finance nuclear threats and conventional adventures. The militancy of Asian communists in turn causes the South Koreans to keep more than 500,000 men under arms, forces Taiwan to maintain 600,000, and South Vietnam, 250,000, keeps Thailand armed and alert, galvanizes India into an unprecedented defense effort, and even keeps the Soviet Union patrolling the world's longest border to deal, so the Soviets themselves say, with hundreds of Chinese incursions into Soviet Asia. Throughout the world, there is competitive buying and competitive selling of arms, and competitive begging and granting of arms as well. For too many political leaders in too many countries, the first answer to every difficult question is the threat or the use of force. They rather remind me of the boy who was applying for a job in our government, and when he answered the standard question, "Do you favor the overthrow of the government by force, subversion, or violence?" He answered with the single word, violence. There is, after all, something grotesque, something unreal, and nightmarish about a world with 20 million men under arms and military budgets of $120 billion when we can't seem to find 20,000 men and $120 million for international peacekeeping. Even Ogden Nash, whose verse was seldom bitter, had an edge, I think, as he wrote those memorable lines: "When geniuses of every nation hasten us toward obliteration, perhaps it will take the dolts and geese to drag us backward into peace." I should like to say a word about disarmament. On the eve of this new conference, the goal is, of course, to achieve a better, a safer world through the application of the principles of the Charter of the United Nations and the steady development of international law and effective peacekeeping arrangements. If we are ever to begin the process of general disarmament, we must start by halting the present arms race, and particularly the nuclear race. We must begin where agreement seems possible, and we must begin now. This is precisely the aim of the program which the United States has already placed before the 18 Nation Disarmament Commission in Geneva, and which we will discuss in detail next week in New York. At Geneva, we have set out, at the direction of President Johnson, a series of far-reaching proposals, an offer to explore an agreement to stop any increase in the numbers of strategic nuclear vehicles and to freeze their characteristics, curbs on the spread of nuclear weapons, stopping production of fissionable materials for weapons, and beginning the process of actual destruction of bombers. We are anxious to see the test ban treaty extended to underground tests and we are prepared to discuss practical measures to guard against surprise attack. These proposals are concrete and practical, and unlike the slogans and the generalities which so often characterize many of the Soviet proposals, they are supported by technical and scientific detail. They deal with complex matters of military balance, of scientific technology and verification, and we accept the need for a full exchange of views before others could be expected to agree upon them. Thus, we are not wholly discouraged by the lack of progress at Geneva last year. There is no short road to arms control or to disarmament. But there is one area in which time is pressing and action has become urgent, and I refer to the dangerous spread of nuclear weapons. Many countries will soon have peaceful power reactors turning out plutonium as a byproduct. And with plutonium, as you know, you can manufacture nuclear weapons. International safeguards must keep pace with this threat. And similarly, we strongly favor an agreement an international agreement to prevent the transfer of nuclear weapons to states which do not possess weapons, and to prevent the latter from producing or seeking such weapons from others. This agreement has been delayed far too long. Why should we not conclude a non-proliferation agreement now, and by so doing, provide reassurance that any further allied nuclear arrangements, such as the MLF or the ALF, would be consistent with the principle of non-dissemination? Why should we not conclude a comprehensive test ban agreement? Why should past differences remain forever unresolved while this dance of death goes on? China has poured its scarce resources into building a nuclear weapon capability, which underscores the need for prompt action. Now its neighbors are confronted with a new threat to their security, and political pressures to follow suit are rising dangerously. If they do, then still others will follow them. And such a chain reaction would only lessen everyone's security. And that is why we applaud the announced policy, for example, of India, to confine its scientific talents to the peaceful uses of atomic energy. But we are mindful of the concern for their security felt by all of the non-nuclear states. And President Johnson has said that the nations that do not seek national nuclear weapons can be sure that if they need our strong support against some threat of nuclear blackmail, then they will have it. In short, we recognize the legitimate security concerns of others, whether allied to us or not, and this problem continues to engage our utmost attention. I hope it will yours. Before I leave disarmament, let me note that some of the smaller nations complain about the lack of progress in dampening down the major arms race, while they themselves are negotiating for the acquisition of advanced jet aircraft or other modern lethal weapons. Sometimes this is done out of exaggerated assessments of their security needs or for prestige considerations. In either case, the result is to add fuel to the regional arms races. Regional initiatives for arms agreements might not only provide a good example for the major powers, but might also enhance regional security. But disarmament is not the only thing that I want you publishers to think about. I want you to think about the United States. I hope you don't think that I'm frivolous in saying that, because to know ourselves, let alone to see ourselves as others see us, is a formidable assignment few of us ever finish. Every nation has difficulty in thinking objectively about itself. There is so much that is understood and taken for granted, so much that is accepted uncritically as climate or geography. But I believe that the American people have some special difficulties in thinking about themselves. In the first place, we are the only great power in history who jumped to overwhelming great powerhood with virtually no outside contacts on the way up. The isolation of the first century of our republic is unique by any standards. There was little reason for us to think about ourselves, about our place in an evolving world context, about the views of others, about the impact of our policies. If I may use the phrase without irreverence, I think America, of all the powers in the world, came nearest to an immaculate conception. And now I come to the second difficulty confronting our view of ourselves. We were the first community to come into being with a declared and positive political, even messianic aim. We sprang from the womb of history, dedicated to a proposition, a new society destined to prove that man could be governed yet free, a new polity which would be the last best hope of man. Now that's pretty heady stuff. I believe that it has profoundly influenced our development. We are today that paradox, a profoundly conservative nation with a vast liberal ideal to conserve. Our stirring dreams are all of liberation and greater equality, of legal rights and social enfranchisement. We can't change our dreams, for we wrote them into the Constitution. We are, if you like, birthright radicals. Since we have to conserve the most soaring political aspiration ever conceived by man. Yet this vast ambition, this sense of legislating for all mankind, which gives the Declaration of Independence its luminous glory, have also had profound effects upon our intermittent efforts at introspection. It's much more agreeable to think of one's community as the last best hope of man than as a settler society which secured a whole continent in fee simple by exterminating the original inhabitants. It's much easier to hold up the banner of freedom against godless tyranny than to remember the plight of the American Negro 100 years after emancipation. These darker pictures are not the whole truth about America, but they are a part of the truth. And the sight of it, which in our rhetoric, our diplomatic posture, and our own imagination, we tend to leave out. So we entered history suddenly and inescapably. And once again, our manner of doing it gave a further twist to our self-imaginings. For in 1945, we entered a world virtually stripped of all power save our own. Is it possible to picture any circumstance more traumatic than this? Here was the United States, largely unconscious of the scale of its wealth and of its power, which it had no previous world policy, strategies, or even views, save that of continuing invulnerability via isolation or the Monroe Doctrine, suddenly pitchforked into a vast vacuum where only its power, its policy, its strategy seemed likely to have any effect. Once again, I doubt if any nation ever had unsought leadership thrust so suddenly upon it. To go to bed, a separate American people, and wake up to find a large part of the world at the bedside clamoring for solutions. Yet this untried community, this inexperienced leadership, produced with virtually no notice astoundingly successful policies. One looks back with a kind of awe at the audacity and the vision of those first post-war years, On the one hand, the rallying of the free world to the policy of containment. On the other, the bold use of American resources in the Marshall Plan to restore the European economy in 4 short years, and to do so on a competitive, on a cooperative basis, which foreshadowed Europe's later experiments in unification. These were stunning achievements. America emerging as a world leader for the first time put up a performance that the wisest veteran could hardly have matched. Yet I believe that our very success has had consequences for our present posture in world affairs that some 15 years later are not altogether happy. We have, in a sense, been a little hypnotized by our own achievements. The sense of unique and successful leadership in a grateful and reasonably compliant coalition has come to be the posture that we understand best. Anything else makes us uneasy and at times resentful. In the Atlantic arena, the policies have proved so efficient that the evils they were designed to meet have, if not vanished at least, so sharply changed their character that we confront a new situation demanding new initiatives. Success has changed the circumstances with which we have had to deal. As Mencken said, by the time everyone accepts a truism, it is no longer true. What we have to ask ourselves today is not whether our policies have been good in the past. That's no longer the question. In this mutable world of breakneck change, we have constantly to re-examine both our assessments and our strategies. Past success, the sense of our manifest destiny, knowledge of our material resources and superiority, all these are not good guides if they confuse us about our present problems and possibilities. As becomes more and more obvious, West European recovery and East European relaxation create wholly new conditions for Atlantic cooperation. The fear is less, the sense of recovered power is greater. I do not myself believe that the underlying unity is lost. If attacked, the alliance would stand. To this extent, containment continues to be the successful base of our policy. That great lady, Eleanor Roosevelt, once said of herself, "What one has to do usually can be done." That has usually been true of our people. I believe they will recognize that where leadership is more difficult because less unilateral, it is bound to be different, but no less necessary. Thank you.